So you had many weeks to drop into the library. Did you manage to get there, or are you relying on what you did before Christmas, before the holidays?
Well, yes and no. It was actually closed for 2 weeks over the holidays.
I have
been there since I last talked to you on the radio here, but
yeah.
Unfortunately haven't had weeks to compile all sorts of stuff. So, I mean, I've got more... Basically, I've got more notes on McLuhan's annotations to Crowds and Power.
Good.
But other than that, I'd have to rely on, you know, other comments or what you were saying about what you were saying recently about the formal cause of
yes.
strange dream I had recently where there's a I dreamed there was a new edition of Finnegan's Wake, an annotated Finnegan's Wake
yeah.
that was edited by Stephen Colbert, which is much more literal than my dreams usually get in terms of like on the nose of kind of my interests.
Yes.
They're usually not quite so in my face in terms of things I consider consciously to be considered important or valuable.
Yeah, it's like you're cheating, yet you're making your dreams be about you.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seemed to be in the service of this confusion of, well, because then in the dream I was confusing the McLuhan annotated books library with a
yeah.
Joyce library of some kind, because then in this Colbert edit, and it was extremely thick, it was as if he had done this massive scholarly task and come out with a book that was twice as thick as Finnegan's Wake, and he compiled everything Joyce or anyone else had ever said about it. And somewhere in, I flipped into his introduction because I suspected in my dream, I'm like, oh, what, did he go to the Toronto Library? And sure enough, in his introduction in the dream, he had said something about, like, and thanks to this library in Toronto. And then I was like, aha, I did see him that time walking on the street nearby or something.
Well, that's a great story. That's not a dream. Yeah. That actually happened in some parallel world.
Well, yeah, I mean, to me, it makes it, well, because after his show, we briefly mentioned that his show was ending, and there was this little thing. Typically, in his last episode, there was, like, I had kind of fallen off of watching it, but typically, as how my experience was years ago when I was watching it intensively, sure enough, there was something that, like, oh, that could be read as a Finnegan's Wake reference or not. At, where he talked about a revolution being, he's like, technically, I did bring you a revolution because nothing changed, and we're in the same situation where there's like a Bush running for the White House and all that. And technically, a revolution is 360 degrees back to where you started, and then there was this pretty lame joke comment about, I left my keys there, and the keys to is the last where Finnegan's Wake comes back to where it starts and resources back to the river.
Right. If Colbert did do what your dream said, that would really have people relook at his TV work. You know, then they know it was super sophisticated, and then he'd qualify as a holy office or something. That would upgrade his intention of what he did do, because all those things you suspect but aren't sure of, if he did yeah. this, edited a new Finnegan's Wake and acknowledged Toronto, then you certainly could
yeah.
Verify your statements about him.
Absolutely. There was one Joyce reference. It was the one time that, I mean, maybe there were other times I didn't catch, but the one time that he made a very explicit Joyce joke was when he was in, not Toronto, but Vancouver, when he was in Canada.
Yeah.
He came up to Vancouver for the Olympics, and he did this pretty funny thing where he was at some, like, bar called, like, the Irish Embassy or something, mm-hmm. and he's talking to this packed crowd, and it was a pretty good joke. He's revving them up. He's like, are you ready for some Irish culture? And they're like, yeah. And he pulls out the Ulysses, like, stately, plunk, buck, mulligan, into the forehead, blah, blah, blah. And then, like, halfway through the sentence, he looks up. He's like, you might want to sit down. This is going to take a while.
That's great. That's
yeah.
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty good. Like, yeah. As long as it's crowdy and rowdy, sure. Oh, fuck. God, give me a break.
Do you know anything about his private life? Do you know anything about his wife?
No, not, I mean, like, I never even knew anything about her name or what she looked like or anything until at the like Emmys last year. I saw he like finally won the Emmy and thanked her or something.
Mm.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I was pretty like, because back when I was kind of obsessed with him, it was very much like I was comfortable with being obsessed with him in quotes, because I was really only obsessed with his character and the space between his character and his artistic intentions. And I really had like, there was no real even temptation to cross over into like his personal life or something like.
So you don't know. Or she
mental life.
So she keeps out of the spotlight. She's
As far as I know, I don't remember her name or what she looks like. I saw her and his kids on TV briefly, and that's it.
Okay. So, which book would you like to look at? You want to continue with Crowds and Power, or there was something else?
Yeah, well, the Crowds and Power is all I really have new notes on.
Okay, that's good.
There are definitely some bunch of interesting things in there, and I know this was one theme that I know Eric McLuhan picked up and ran with a bit. And mentioned in his book, Electric Language.
Yes.
Or actually, I remember that this is pretty relevant to the Crowds and Power thing. So I remember Eric saying that his title for the book was The Electric Crowd. And that's kind of the major theme of the book. He talks about the electric crowd, but that the publisher thought Electric Language would sell better or whatever, so that's what it ended up shifting to.
Yes.
And he talks about how the electric crowd is very similar to the crowd of, maybe he mentions Canetti in that book. Now I need to go back and look at that. But definitely in Crowds and Power, this very same point is made that the crowd of the dead, idea of like all our ancestors being that this is our most primitive conception of the crowd.
Yeah.
There's a quote, over the whole earth, wherever there are men, is found the conception of the invisible dead. And McLuhan underlines invisible dead. And beside it, McLuhan wrote silent minority.
Usually he would say in the early 70s during the Nixon administration, he would talk about the silent majority. That's who Nixon said his mandate was from, the silent majority.
Right.
And he used it in his debate with W.H. Auden back in February 1971. Bucky Fuller, I think, was on the panel. Very interesting event. The people were quite divided whether Auden or Joyce or McLuhan won. And I actually that summer was in New York City, and I went to Auden's address, 7 St. Mark's Place or something, and it was indicated somewhere, and there was a young man there. Auden was back in Oxford, London, England, doing his academic stuff, and so I got to talk to the guy who was bed-sitting for him, and he was a good friend, and I brought up the McLuhan thing, and he said, yes, when Auden, this is the top poet of the pre-World War II period, W.H. Auden, and the kind of poetry that McLuhan had definitely attacked and thought was not appropriately responding to the discoveries of Ezra Pound and Eliot and Joyce. So this guy tells me that when Auden came back from Toronto after that panel, he walked into the apartment and said to this young man, the first thing, I won! The first he said, and of course, me, the archivist, finds out this by tracking down these people and find out that summer, you know, that Auden was quite convinced that he'd beat McLuhan. And there was a, you know, these guys read up on each other. They know what's, they're doing this nice public address at a panel in the University of Toronto with the academics keeping everybody polite, yet underneath it is this war going on, and it's serious. And McLuhan, actually, when you re-listen to the recording, from my point of view, McLuhan whooped Auden really bad. Auden didn't do well. Auden even refused to debate at a certain point, refused to discuss it anymore, just said, I don't care about the modern world. I'm living in the past. That was his defense. And then, and you wouldn't
kind of like as if that's what artists are supposed to do.
Right, right. And he... you wouldn't think that he even cared that he was competing with McLuhan. But the first thing he says to his buddy when he gets back to New York, I won, and his kid buddy was supposed to know what he meant, you know?
Right, yeah.
So that's pretty neat. And then Auden, he died a couple years later. He didn't go far after that. He probably was killed by McLuhan and took a couple years to take it in, accept his suicide. Okay, back to, so, the silent majority, McLuhan talks about it in that lecture, that panel, the silent majority was the people that Nixon was...
It was a pretty new phrase then in the 70s.
The early 70s.
It was that morphed into the moral majority in the 80s.
Right, exactly. So what happened? You had the noisy minorities, the pinheads and intellectuals and Jews that Spiro Agnew went after, so he named these people. They were the noisy minority. And so Nixon wrote in offering participatory democracy for the silent majority. Okay.
Right. And so, it's only the liberal media that makes it look like it's a majority of the actual
minority. Yes. Well, that's why McLuhan said, if you ask McLuhan what the silent majority was, he said, the dead, the planet of the dead. He considered the silent majority were wiser than the noisy people because the silent majority knew they were dead. Chemical body was obsolete, and this kind of super angel reality taken over. So it was a very precise statement and use of the term. So here he's saying silent minority. That's incredible.
Yeah, right beside underlining invisible dead.
Okay, so that would mean that the visible living in the world here, silent majority, who are dead technically due to virtual reality, which doesn't exist, but it's an effect, they are the majority. There are more of them than the people in the astral plane. So I'm thinking he's saying the actually physically old terms of dead are a minority. So there's more.
I was wondering if he was referring to, like, this idea that the population explosion or something, this thought, like, are there more people alive than have ever been alive? Like,
and he said a large part of that, that the population explosion for chemical bodies was an illusion. He says you could fit the population of the world into Alberta in a well-designed bunch of cities. And so that would be, he says, the population explosion is a misnomer, a rearview mirror image for the discarnate image implosion, where everybody's claustrophobic because they're drowned out by the imagery in the media. And that was really the huge numbers. Now, if you count them, that would be the silent majority. If you count the imagery as part of your numeracy, then, yes, the silent majority is bigger than the actual dead people up there waiting with Jesus.
Right, because, I mean, for in the annotations here in Invisible, in the Crowds in Power, it's only just a few notes here and there, but definitely, and where Canetti takes it a couple pages later in the book, it's very much aligned with the slightly different place that Eric McLuhan took it, where he was talking in the book, but presumably Eric was pretty faithfully transcribing, like, what McLuhan thought about this idea, too, with this this idea that there's this strong similarity or resonance of some kind between the crowd of the dead and the electric crowd of the sort of potential that new type of audience created by the electronic or electronic
media. Yeah, and so the first person to go into that, and this is where Eric, you know, he did his PhD on Finnegan's Wake, but Don Thiel would say that Eric and Marshall regard the wake from a Lewisian, Wyndham Lewis perspective, or Menippean satire, as opposed to Veronian, based on Vero. And Vero was more carnivalesque and more hedonistic and celebrated Eros, in a way, more than Lewis did. So you have both McLuhans being Lewisian Menippean satirists and regarding the wake that way, and Thiel representing the Veronian version of Menippean satire. Veronian satire, which is mistaken as Menippean. So Don Thiel, he clarifies that pretty good and makes a good case for his point in his books, the Beyond the Word and James Joyce's Technopoetics. But the big theme from Wyndham Lewis back in the, I guess, late teens, early into the 20s, is the crowd master and how everybody's a puppet due to the crowd master. So Eric naming it the electric crowd is a Lewisian nod. Definitely, he's being Wyndham Lewis there by bringing in the crowd dynamic, who laid it out before Canetti, but Canetti did a really good job later building on it. But just for a side note, that's a Wyndham Lewis title, The Electric Crowd. Did you know Do you know enough about Lewis to know I'm
Well, I remember it makes me for sure, and I'm sure it's there in Lewis's non-fiction-y critic prose as well, but it really brings to mind the opening scene of the Childermass, where it's all freshly killed war victims are in this big confused mass out in the new part of the afterlife, and
that is the Electric Crowd.
When they're, yeah,
he's talking. Lewis is talking about. You would read it as if it's literally dead guys. Was it Pullum and somebody? The two guys are drifting for 122 pages around the astral bardos, but actually, it's a reference to the effect of the BBC of the new radio environment in England.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting because you wouldn't suspect that. You think he's just very imaginatively describing the afterlife and the outskirts of the Magnetic City, outside of the gates of the Magnetic City, that the terrain, if you go away from the crowd, things get kind of chaotic. But the truth is, his descriptions of how, the sort of dangerous chaos that they encounter when they're moving away from the crowds of people takes the form of, modern art. Kind of descriptions of how their perceptions get warped and strange. And so it's like, it's a strange point about how we were all killed by the First World War.
Yeah. And Magnetic City is Lewis's term for the global theater, the global village, as a, what I would later call a global membrane, the implosion of everybody in this weird electric space, the discarnate space. And so you have the perceptions of of the Pullman and Satyrs. They're like the after image of the chemical body walking around London and watching everybody listen to the BBC, and BBC is Magnetic City. So the marginalization of those guys floating around is actually accurate for what the chemical body lives like when they're in London in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
And this book was written in 1928. It is the first response to Finnegan's Wake, which is not a book yet. It's just serialized as work in progress. And here's people don't even know Joyce is doing it because it's in obscure cultural magazines. And they don't know what he's doing if they do. Everybody thinks he's lost it. And here's Lewis knowing exactly what he's doing and actually enhancing and responding as a dialogue that only he and Joyce were equipped to do. And he makes fun.
Heard that
but let me just say this point, the final point. He satirizes the Finneganese in his book in 1928. 11 years before Finnegan's Wake's published. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Speed forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, if it's going to take him so long to finish this thing, I'm going to get him advanced speed forward. Because, I've heard that it was well after I read the books, and so I should go back. They're such interesting books, that Human Age trilogy. I want to go back and read them. But, I've heard that the Pullman character is supposed to sort of be Joyce, or especially later on when he gets involved in the workings of the Magnetic City.
And with the devil, with Samael.
Yeah,
with the devil in the two later parts, the Malign Fiesta and Magister, I forget what the other one, Monster Gay and the Malign Fiesta are parts two and three, and I may have got them in reverse. But the important point is, what was I going to say? This thing about magnetic. Oh, yeah. When we were talking to Ion and eventually talking to McLuhan back in McLuhan and Maui, you can hear the recordings where we go into Eliot. What did he do? It was unique to him. What was Joyce's contribution? What did Lewis do? What did Yeats do? And Ion points out that Lewis was the only one, and he outlived the others pretty well. He was the only one who I would say he outlived them creatively. Pound had, locked himself into treasonous behavior. Eliot was just keeping his estate together, managing Faber, the publisher. So here's Lewis writing five more books while blind. And Ion said that he was the only one dealing with the phenomenon of angels. And what would happen to the angel in the new electronic super angelization of humanity? And that's pretty profound. So from Ion's point of view, Lewis was dealing with what was coming in Iondom. So that's something that no one else would ever say or know about, and there it is. You can go hear it in one of the later McLuhan and Maui stuff when we're talking to McLuhan through Ion.
Right. Right. The well, yeah, for that, it quickly reminds me of one of the reasons why I always, it seemed like a confirmation of Lewis being more ahead of his time than the other folks of his time that he criticized, was that the surrealists and the surrealist cubist kind of paradigm, that surrealist flavored art became very popular for like album covers and stuff in the 60s and 70s, but it wasn't until the 90s and the aughts that the more hard-edged Wyndham Lewis-y vorticist kind of designs became popular among like electronic music sort of people, that his aesthetic, his visual aesthetic became popular again decades after the more surrealist aesthetic became popular again.
How about this? It just occurs to me that the surrealistic is playing off the consumer dreams that LSD brought in, and I'm referring to McLuhan's review of Burroughs, whereas heroin, you put on the whole world instantly, you put on the whole universe. Lewis's art was more towards putting on the whole world, wearing the whole world through Magnetic City and super angelization, as opposed to wonderful consumer images that LSD provided. So
yeah,
that's why later... Yeah, later, Lewis
is... Although that especially, that makes me think of the idea that, like, I'm that maybe McLuhan was reading that into heroin specifically more because that's what Burroughs was on.
Yeah.
But that whole putting on the universe thing has always, like, in my experience, that's much more of a, like, ketamine K-hole kind of thing than a heroin thing. Like, heroin is ultimately a useless, boring thing.
Yeah.
Like, and but the ketamine is this whole much more interesting mental, like the word psychedelic would come to mind in terms of just like, wow, this is an astonishing new realm, but it's not, it's nothing like the psychedelics. But reaching for a description like it allows you to put, make your body into an environment which includes the universe seems to actually, because the difference between psychedelics and the dissociatives like ketamine is that with psychedelics you can't describe them because there's too much to say, whereas you come out of a K-hole and you can't come up with word one to describe it. Like, it's just so, it was such a shocking, profound thing, but you don't know where to begin. You can't say anything. And like the what McLuhan said about your body becoming an environment which includes the universe seems like, you know, there's one rare tentative step towards perhaps describing what that experience is actually like. So I'm not sure about the whole heroin.
No, that's really good.
I feel like that's giving heroin too much credit, really.
Okay.
Heroin doesn't seem to go beyond psychedelics like ketamine does.
Right.
And ketamine became much more popular in the rave scene.
Yeah, so the ketamine is the third position. It does a bit of the LSD and a bit of the junkie and more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, is that what is that connected to the DMT that Terrence McKenna celebrated, or did he ever talk about ketamine? What's the difference between
DMT? He did, and he really emphasized the differences more, that, DMT is very much a psychedelic, and he did mention ketamine, and he talked about the reasons why he was not so much interested in it, one of them being that it's like I don't like that you have to basically like inject it, and or that it's like a demon artifice of the laboratory thing. He's like, I'd prefer to go with stuff that people have actually been using for a long time, because that has a, he talked about how, you know, when you take mushrooms or something, that because of the, he started using the phrase morphic field later after hanging out with Sheldrake a lot, but that when you take mushrooms or something, you're sailing with every shaman that ever took mushrooms, whereas that his impression of ketamine was that it was as if it was this giant empty building. Like, its morphic field had not been written yet, and that it was a lot less interesting to him shamanically then. And he also just expressed a kind of a distasteful bafflement with the idea that, like, yeah, it's really something, but it's like it wipes you out so much that the, you know, the first revelation you have on it is like, oh, right, I'm a person who's high on a drug. Like, you completely forget, it just wipes you out so much. Like, you might be changed by the psychedelics, but you're still, oh my God, I'm experiencing all this shit. Whereas with the ketamine, you vanish. Like, you're not there anymore, and then you come to, like, oh, right, there's reality going on.
Okay.
And so he kind of felt like that's a bit not so useful. It's a bit too much or something.
Okay. Now, is ketamine what John Lilly celebrated?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, didn't he do a lot of it? That's what he preferred?
Yeah.
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 I remember.
And I think Leary also had a similar kind of, like, he didn't really celebrate it a lot or get into it a lot, but I believe that he did at least once assign ketamine to the, like, eighth circuit. Like, he talked about circuits of the brain.
Yeah.
And how cannabis or whatever will turn on circuit five.
Right.
And the psychedelics will turn on circuit six and seven, but when you get up to the neuroatomic eighth circuit, that's what ketamine will put you in touch with. But, you know, that's also a much more obliterative level. You know, the level of organization is, like, makes sense that you're not really there for that experience when you get to the neuroatomic.
Right. I have a couple of those Leary books. Some of them he did with Robert Anton Wilson, Info Psychology something, and I think I had the one
right.
with that chart in it. I have to go check that. So how did we get – now back to the electric crowd and what – we've done Silent Minority. That's very – when you know McLuhan's always talking about the Silent Majority, it's very significant that he put Silent Minority in that part. You know, that's
mm-hmm.
telling. So what's your next footnote or annotation?
Well, a couple pages later, Canetti shifts from talking about the crowd of the invisible dead to the crowd of the yet to come and posterity.
Mm-hmm.
And when he's talking, when Canetti says, McLuhan underlined the word posterity, and then Canetti later says, it is precisely when it has become numberless that posterity is visible to no one, like the idea that your future audience, the number of your future audience has become numberless, that you're not thinking of, like, oh, I've got 1,000 or 100,000 readers now, but when you think of the future and it's a limitless audience forever.
So it becomes one?
Well, Canetti said, it is precisely when it has become numberless that posterity is visible to no one.
Oh.
And McLuhan underlined that entire part and wrote audience as cliché.
Yeah. Wow.
And he also wrote, he put a CA beside it as well.
Yeah, that's cliché to archetype. Which means, and he says you can exchange cliché and archetype. They merge like...
Right.
He used to say, Vitticus Wake, Joyce figured out how to make a whole universe out of two words, but it's hendiadies, one by means of two. And I actually heard in one of my McLuhan recordings that I acquired, they talk about hendiadies that way. And, okay, so now, so this, it says, okay, so you have two words, cliché archetype, it's two words for one, and what is the one? It's the process of cognition. The phases of awareness somehow. It can be one or four. But what did you say that he's saying the audience disappears when it's numberless? I'm not sure if I get what Canetti's saying.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I only wrote down the sentence fragment that McLuhan had underlined,
oh.
So I'm not totally sure of the context anymore. But, I mean, it's... So McLuhan's note was audience as cliché. So if that's kind of interchangeable with archetype, it's the real archetype of your audience is like, well, even if the people of today don't fully understand me, if I'm part of the pantheon of people who are read forever, you know, that's the archetypal audience where you know, everyone's heard of me and some ideal people in the future will be my ideal readers or something like
yeah.
that. So, like, the archetype audience, the cliché audience. But it's interesting because he also, Canetti then brings it to that the other crowd, you've got the crowd of the dead and the ancestors, and then the kind of virtual invisible crowd of future, of posterity. But then he talks about this other strange, newly visible because of microscope crowd, that's the crowd of spermatozoa,
mm.
and that they are like in this weird way that they are the ancestors, that each of them, quote, as Kennedy says, carries with it everything of our ancestors, which will be preserved. It contains our ancestors. It is them. So, you know, we've got this influence, mental, virtual, mimetic influence of our ancestors, but then there's also this physical presence of the ancestors, and that it's, to Kennedy, it's very, very significant that that's in a crowd form, that it's not as if, you know, the man shoots one bullet, and that it's this giant crowd that all have the same goal. And so it's similar to the posterity and...
Well, it sounds like that one is the now, is the now, the Middle Kingdom,
right,
that contains the past and the future. It's full of potential,
right,
and
yeah,
and the future merges into an anonymous cliche. So what does he make of this present, the crowd of the present? What does he develop there? Do you have any notes on that?
I mean, Kennedy just kind of leaves it there, basically, with this, like, it seems that Kennedy's punchline or something is just that, kind of, isn't it interesting that that's a crowd?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, that's the, yeah.
And McLuhan is basically, McLuhan in the part of that sperm, he only underlined the phrase same goal, for they all have the same goal, all the sperm.
And that would be, now that could be the mechanical uniform industrial phase, but it also can be the mystical body of Christ, where everybody, he called it the destination syndrome, that since nobody could land anymore, goals were obsolete, everybody's floating and expecting the unexpected, he said it led to the destination and the obsessing about what's our fate, what's our, the whole society gets into wondering where we're going, what is Obama going to do, you know, what's the word that makes America going to do. That's what that to me, that sounds like when it's the same goal that is not not going to be realized. It's not going to be actualized, but everybody's united by it. Now, that's the effect of software communism in the super angel state, too.
Well, this anxiety about the future thing is, that's where Eric McLuhan took it when he talked about all these themes in the Electric Crowd or Electric Language,
yes,
the actual title you can find it under. But his little twist on it, though, in terms of talking about like the 90s or now, he was talking about it in terms of, he was trying to explain why abortion is such a big deal. He was basically saying that the kind of feeling of panic at the approach of a child is a symptom of our new disembodied electronic state. That the idea of being in this, you know, we're in this discarnate. We are part of the electric crowd, and that the that's why we are so panicked by the idea of this incoming embodiment and want to just make them go away.
Yeah, he did talk about how the child was forgotten as people got more involved electronically with pattern recognition and worrying of the destination syndrome. Everybody forgot the physical, chemical body children. And he said they just got sloughed off. So that's complimentary to this. Uh-oh, here actually comes one. People used to ask me on CKL, what do you think of abortion? I said, well, it's a rather late operation. The whole issue is not important because we've all been collectively aborted. We've all been made Planet of the Dead under the TV global theater conditions. So abortion was like a rearview mirror. Okay, let's be concerned about a couple of babies that are going to be born or not born because we can't focus on the fact we aren't here anymore and have been disappeared.
Right.
That was my way of evading the debate, taking sides. You could always use McLuhan's stuff to get out of the taking a side. What?
I was just laughing, exactly, right.
Yeah.
Coming up with a novel position that also just happens to not take a side.
Yes, and he would. I mean, there's the famous controversy. A bunch of feminists arranged a debate with him in Toronto, and they're all looking forward. This is at the peak of feminism when it was looking very strong, and they were working toward the ERA amendment legislation in Washington, and of course that got beat, and that pretty well killed the feminist dynamism for a while, until Madonna came back with a new version. But so here they are with their peak of power, and they're going to get that macho Lewisian McLuhan, call him on the carpet, get him in there. And so McLuhan didn't even show up. and the feminists were outraged, you know, the top feminists of Toronto, of Canada, in the literati. And they had press conferences blasting McLuhan. McLuhan was kind of chuckling. And I actually have the article. I should look it up. And he had some, you know, third position. He says, abortion, why should I show up and engage in obsolete verbality? I mean, there's a larger debate going on. Blah, blah, blah. So he did it right in public.
That's serious. That, I mean, to me, that almost seems like and it's interesting because I just yesterday, for the first time, like, ever, I saw there was an actual an anti-abortion commercial on TV, which I thought was really odd. Like, maybe that happens in the States a lot, but not here.
Yeah.
And it was because you're not, like, there's this whole, like, taboo against discussing that in Parliament at all. Like, even the conservative prime minister comes in with a majority, and he's like, don't worry, no one will be allowed to discuss abortion.
Yeah.
And it's like, there is this whole, like, you can go and look at this one journalist did a really good job of compiling all the ways that the conservatives have been surreptitiously building this subject up,
yeah,
and aligning it sneakily with the MPs and Parliament and all this, but it's interesting that officially it's not on the table. But, so yeah, and it's not on TV or anything, but there was just a commercial yesterday, and the conceit that they're using in the commercial is showing all these scenes of happy people, and I mean, you know, this is where, I mean, the main argument a lot of people use is like, well, it's you know, not, like, a lot of the people, the reason that they would abort a kid is because they're not going to have a great life or their parents aren't ready. But, you know, in the commercial, it's all these super happy privileged.
Yeah, happy to be alive.
Yeah, they're all happy to be alive, and they're running along playing soccer, and then a few of them just fade away because they were never born. And then there's these people getting married, and then the bride fades away because she was never born. So they're emphasized. So that kind of reminds me of what McLuhan's doing. It's like, well, you're what if the guy that you want to debate, I was never born. It's like, I just don't show up.
And you've got Carolyn's recently, we were talking about it, new statistics that in Berlin, I think Roxana told me this, two-thirds, is it, Carol? Or one-third of the children are ill? Or no, maybe it's two-thirds.
Yeah, 130% in Berlin, and there's a documentary on it, but it's in German. But they made mention that in America, two-thirds of the children are ill.
Yeah. This is
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
That's a lot of people who are stuck with medication and even worse problems from that. So there's a good case of believing Dave Worster and the womb is being closed and don't bother having any children. It's just going to be a headache for you because society will manage them beyond your ability to manage the kids. So you got to be careful if you're getting pregnant. And we see a lot of people here in the beach, a lot of people getting married. They come here to the Maui paradise to be photographed in front of the chapel and on the beach with their bride, modern, up-to-date bride uniforms. And I always think, it looks rather ghostly. These must be from parallel worlds, these people. Okay,
yeah.
So what we're pointing out here, the sperm as a new crowd. That's pretty good.
Yes.
That's almost Kennedy's image, unconscious image for the discarnate state. He said there's a collectivity that's neither past or present, but is in the now, full of potentiality that we have to consider. But he didn't know how to go any further on it.
Right.
He didn't develop it.
Yeah.
Okay, the next quote?
There's some kind of, a next thing, it's...
No, you're going to say something. There's some kind of, go ahead with that thought.
Oh, no, I'm just saying there's some kind of connection to this other point or other thing that McLuhan underlined and had a little note beside, like where he's talking about the sperm, they all have the same goal and that they're a type of crowd that way. They all have the same kind of goal. There was another few pages earlier, Kennedy was talking about... throbbing crowds as a particular type of crowd.
Yeah.
And he says, and McLuhan's underlined a few phrases here, one of the sentences that Kennedy talks about, he says, thanks to the dominance of rhythm, all throbbing crowds have something similar in their appearance. And McLuhan's underlined dominance of rhythm and underlined similar in their appearance, and written beside it CF Med something, which I think he's saying medieval painting.
Yes.
The whole thing about how people in medieval paintings, generally, even when you're not just the anonymous crowd people, but even very specific people, there's very little attention paid to trying to have any visual high definition striking
characteristics, individual characteristics.
Yeah, everyone's face looks the same.
Right. So what, that was C-M?
Oh, no, sorry, CF.
CF?
You know, just little lowercase, not one of McLuhan's shorthand.
Oh, he means reference. CF means
reference. Yes, he also.
Reference. Yeah, and
medieval painting.
Yeah, and that would be jazz. He talks about how jazz unites the world with rhythm, acoustic rhythm and the new electric tactility. So I'm looking for the return to medieval sensibility, which so much of the medieval characteristics are in Finnegan's Wake. You can find it in there. So Eric and Marshall would say that Joyce was sort of seduced by the characteristics of medieval life retrieved by radio. And then you have the dithyrambic spectator is the person, the puppet of the jazz world. That's Wyndham Lewis's term. So you have this ambivalence between eye view of the new electric discarnate state and the ear view. You can be an eye neoconservative or a member of the mother's invention as an ear person, you know, ear versus eye. And the satellite conductor, McLuhan and Zappa, are neither eye nor ear. That's why they have staying power.
Mm.
And that could be considered Joyce. If you want to favor Joyce over Lewis, then Joyce expressed the tactility, the interval position, better than Lewis did. So depends what your personality is, which side you take. But you need to read both to understand both.
A lot of the notes in here are basically along similar lines of McLuhan adding his little comment that basically points toward the newly eerified nature.
Yeah.
Where Canetti says he's numbering, listing his attributes of crowds, and beside where Canetti has said, number two, within the crowd there is equality, McLuhan says, i.e. no private identity.
Right. Yeah, what you find is that when
similarity of appearance and that kind of thing.
Yeah. What you find in McLuhan is he's dealing with the book medium here and all the book authors, and he would say all of them are within the eye-ear debate. The lesser of them take one side or the other to fully, you know, numb and not understanding what the tactile level of the 20th century. So you'll see he's repeating eye-ear as a criticism dialectic all through the books, because only the book, that's all the book can do, take that side, unless they do Finneganese, which is unreadable. So most people won't do it. So it's almost he's marking paper, showing the cliche response, which becomes an archetypal response, of the average thinker of his time. They're staying within the eye-ear dialectic, and that's only a figure for McLuhan. He's more watching the kinetic tactile dialectic. So that's why McLuhan, I think if people looked at these annotations after a while, they'd see, well, geez, all he's doing is eye-ear all the way through it in every one of these authors. Well, they got to realize McLuhan was finding the book medium pretty limited in dealing with the present. And most people were stuck within that dialectic as writers.
Oftentimes his notes are basically just there's not a lot. You can't really go anywhere to. They're not a note that then leads to a paragraph so much as they are just leads to a dismissal of or the defining of that whole thing into that category.
Yeah, he's saying tell us something new, and he always said Finnegan's Wake did present something new, and that Marshall was the guy who came up with newer new, hendiadistically speaking, because he knew how to translate the Wake and into the present. So McLuhan was on a whole other level as a writer and had no problem saying that he was a cartoonist, and that was the most appropriate way to be.
Yeah. Yeah, making,
Medieval cartoons in the sense of not showing individual particulars. Like he used to say, all the John Travoltas or the Carlos Castanedas. Now, that's shocking for those that get a lot of the Castaneda or like John Travolta. How could you make him more than one? He's a unique, charismatic, individual artist on his own right. And McLuhan would lump them into a syndrome. And the Bucky Fullers and the this and the that and the McLuhanites. So that was part of his satire, is that he would collectivize those that were momentarily seeming to be retrieving individualist, charismatic, artistic values. And he said, no, you are subsumed by the posse of Porter Peas, quoting Finnegan's Wake, page 23, mishmash of the super angel state that you didn't even notice oft, you and your family.
Yeah.
So, is there another quote?
Yeah. Some of these notes, though, are more interesting, and sometimes it's I'd be pretty mystified. Like here's one here that it's very tasty. I'm glad I knew what he was referring to in this section where Canetti is talking about the rhythmic or throbbing crowd. He starts this section on rhythm, talking about footsteps, and man has always listened to the footsteps of other men. He has certainly paid more attention to them than his own. Animals, too, have their familiar gait, and it's like, you know, listening to the different footsteps of different animals around was, an important part of our knowing what is going on in our environment, this early acousticness. There is a note McLuhan put beside that for CA, cliche archetype, invis, and so cliche archetype, invisible environment, beside this footsteps and idea of footsteps. But then Canetti says a more interesting thing later on, talking about this rhythmic or throbbing crowd the rhythmic or throbbing crowd is created basically by an investment of many footsteps in place rather than, like, these footsteps are not spent on their usual function of moving somewhere.
Mm, right.
You know, that instead you just put all the steps in the same place and everyone's jumping and stomping and dancing in the same spot. And it's kind of like investing all of these steps in one spot that builds up an intensity. And McLuhan has a little note beside this, just says, Fig 8. And I assume that what he means by that is the idea that in old films that they would make a fake crowd by having just a few people in a fake eight.
He has the word F-A-K-E there, fake eight?
No, fig eight, like figure eight.
Oh, okay, figure eight, yeah.
Yeah. So that would be a pretty mysterious, if you didn't know that he had mentioned and really liked that anecdote about the old film world. People make a fake crowd by having just half dozen people in a figure eight.
Yes, that was Cecil B. DeMille, I think, said that. So that's the interesting thing. Now, there's Canetti talking about footsteps. Well, McLuhan did an essay in the 40s, Footsteps in the Sands of Crime. It's a pretty amazing essay. So it's interesting that footsteps, he knows he's using it as a code for things, and he sees Canetti is picking up on it. And I used to say, you can hear it on Bosnian Ecology, that we never left 1945. We've been dancing on the same spot since then.
Right.
And that's what he's – Canetti's actually pointing that out, in a way.
Yeah, something interesting there.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, Canetti is basically pointing at, like, that would be more, I'd say, relevant to you kind of talking about how Terence McKenna's archaic revival is sort of subordinate to your vision or something.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's part of how what we're doing now is creating that, because Canetti's talking about how that's basically our most archaic mode of that listening to the footsteps and the rhythm of the footsteps and creating a big throbbing crowd.
Right. Now, I want to just see, there's a couple of people here. I want to see if Corbin has something to say to this, see what ideas he come him. So, Corbin, you can speak about this topic, not other nutty stuff, but do you have anything to say about it?
Would you like me to say?
No, what are you thinking about what we're saying?
Several things. I'm a little bit under the weather, so my verbalization skills are a little bit hoarse. Speaking to horse, what was the horse that speaks? Essentially, an illusion can always be presented through the medium of which it's presented. For instance, the horse, Ed or Dr. Ed, or what was the horse's name? It wasn't actually, the horse actually Mr. Ed, he didn't actually speak English, but through the medium of television, black and white TV, he was a very favorite of that time continuum, that medium where Mr. Ed, he would speak in these lyrical, sing-song, philosophical, but very simplistic and to the point, a yes or a no. Sometimes if you keep things just to sentence, it pretty much gets right to the heart of the matter instead of all the blah, 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 blah,
yeah,
blah,
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 iconic,
blah, blah.
And that's appropriate to TV. You'd be iconic as opposed to narrative narrating. But okay, but we're talking about the footsteps and the electric crowd. You have any ideas that come from that?
Well, anyway, yes, I have a couple. You had mentioned earlier that something that Tim Leary, something about ketamine, they didn't.
Yes,
he didn't take to experimenting with it because it had to be injected or whatever.
Yeah.
Tim Leary is on the internet and through friends that I've talked to until the day he passed away. And now this is it's a common theme that on the day of their death, not only Tim Leary but several other philosophers and whatnot, they always have this saying that I'm perplexed right before they pass away. And I don't know why they use this same common reoccurring theme. Now, ketamine, from what little I know about it, anyway, from what little I know about it, it's like they call it being stuck in a K-hole. And essentially, a friend of mine had given me some of it to try out. He said, "Look, man, don't do more than a match head of this because it was pure pharmaceutical grade for humans. It wasn't for animals." And it was like actually having a psychedelic experience, except it only lasted about 3 to 7 minutes. And your body does not move. You're sitting there observing your environment. You're coming to a realization that what would happen if your body was trapped in this this space where you could perceive everything at once, but you couldn't move or respond to it at the same time.
That's interesting. That's like tactility. It's not a sense, so it's a kind of paralysis. Where is tactility? You know, it's in the node of not having any visual affinity or kinetic movement. So sounds like K evokes a tactless paralysis.
No. It evokes basically a mentalist speech that doesn't need to be spoken. The tactile sense becomes obsolete.
Okay. Let me just check with Brian. What do you make of that? Does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, but, like, definitely yes, but it kind of goes back to what I was saying about ketamine kind of stymieing speech.
Any word, yeah.
Because, yes, it's like, yes, but I don't know what to say about it in the same way that if I just said no, I wouldn't know what to say about it.
Right, so like, you're saying the opposite, of course.
It's just kind of a mystery of a way that, like, you just have these profoundly mysterious, there seems to be some sort of communication of something, but it really is just tactile in a way that's just, that means more profoundly nonverbal rather than.
Yeah, and so Corbin's saying that it obsolesces tactility and allows speech. Is that what you said, Corbin?
No, quite the opposite. It obsolesces tactility and it obsolesces speech. You're basically in a non-time zone.
Non-communicative.
A non-time zone where everything's happening at once and you're the observer.
Yeah. So you can't communicate. You don't. There's no reason. No.
You can. It's all communicating to you. It's like being
right.
in
you
the
can't
Hobbit
pass
world.
On anybody else. There's no point in communicating, which would be the condition of people today. They do a lot of texting because they're panicking, being in the K state of hard to communicate all that I am experiencing here with the five bodies. So,
it's as if there's no focusing of the communication or something. There's no possible aiming or focusing or cohering of it, that it's just a more total, constant
communication. I would have to say quite a little bit of the opposite, that there's so much happening at once that you're literally paralyzed. Is to know what it's like to be paralyzed. If we're disagreeing on the aesthetics of the conversation, Brian, then you're correct. I don't know if you can relate to what I'm saying. I'm sure you can.
Paralysis, and Brian is saying paralysis. So what's the difference?
Yeah, I think
okay,
I get what you're talking.
Okay, fabulous. Now, there's another thing that's going on that I find most disturbing. There's such a lack of identity for the younger generation. On the one hand, there's so many that are positive and that are doing so many wonderful things and that will continue to do things and for the next 100, I would say 220 years, 175 years, if it lasts that long. It may not last that long. But at the same time, they're so scared of their identity that they have to, under anonymous autonomy, hide from each other. It's a tag your it sort of thing. What's the guy's name? The Tom Hartman show where he goes, democracy is not a spectator sport. It's you have to be involved. Tag you're it. You know, whatever. Tom Hartman can be very entertaining, but yet he has his soapbox that he must stand upon.
Right.
And but anyway, what's happening is through all the digital cerebrious. Halloween, shall we say, that's being produced. Everybody's running from everybody, and that would be the opposite of phatic communion. Phatic communion would be, hi, how are you doing? Hi, how are you doing? We basically say nothing to each other, but we observe that we're both existing. Now,
yeah, let me add to that, Corbin. McLuhan and Carpenter are saying speech is disappearing in the late 60s, so the baby boomers and Generation X float along emphatic and then manipulative. And then they're hardly really saying anything like people did 100 years ago. But then when they see their kids refusing to be fatty, they say, uh-oh, these kids are socially stupid. They don't know how to have a social life. And the parents are only hoping they become fatty. So you led to an interesting point there, Corbin.
Yeah, I was taking what you were, because you were talking about the, that they're so basically terrified of their identity or whatever, that that it's like the kids today, they only feel comfortable having any kind of phatic interplay that way when there's this strict identitylessness. Like, it's kind of what you were talking about, but I just read this book on the anonymous activist folks, and that really, it's interesting how literally that dramatizes the situation of your identity or a specific identity being a complete disaster. That it's like they're very happy, you know, it was very much not just a goal-driven, politically driven, doing useful tasks kind of thing. It was very much a lot of just trolling and bullshitting and stuff, and they're very comfortable having a lot of phatic communication and phatic communion between each other, as long as they don't care to know who you are. It's like,
right,
you're just screen name, that's fine, you know? Like, if your identity is just a little fabricated brand, cool, that's even better. I feel much more comfortable being phatic and bullshitty with you that way. And it really dramatizes the way that as soon as if they can pin an identity on anyone, boom, they're killed. They go down and they're in jail for 15 years.
So, yeah, this is the five-body model.
Is that bureaucracy body name and file and history of a person? Boom, you're in jail.
Well, the five-body model applies here. And we're going to I'm starting a new radio show on Tuesdays with younger people, and what you're talking about today really fits into that. But I see a panic connectivity. They must remain typing and connecting because even the chip body is being threatened. So it's a hyper use of the chip body to stay connected, not even caring about what is responding to you in chemical body terms. But the chemical body is what's frightening, and that was abortion. You know, the fetus being born was, a real chemical body is showing up. We're going to have to set aside $500,000 to educate this body for 18 years and all this budget that goes into social organization around the children. As McLuhan used to say, the child is king. So, there's a real fear. Now, I would say that the chemical body, it's a misplaced idea. That what they're afraid of is the power of the ascended body, or what Ion would call the hexatic body that's coming forth. And that's what everybody is panicking and hiding from. And the kids think it's the chemical body, a rearview mirror image. But no, there's a new body afoot.
Here's a question. to pass and ponder for a moment. And this would go right along with the abortion issue, or the hexonic body, if Ion's leading in that direction, which is very much an occultist, Illuminati term, whatever version, however you want to put it. Does the life actually begin when the love making, it's such wonderful stuff, but anyway, it is a procreative state that your DNA, RNA, all the above, is your soul catching, the soul catcher's net, so to speak, is being passed along. When the fetus is aborted, is that individual already a soul? Or are they being obliviated by having their fetus removed at that point? Essentially, what it means, do they already exist and they're portaling to a different dimension because they say, wait a minute, this place fucking sucks, so I'm going to go to a different dimension.
I get an answer for that. At least quoting Ion, and I would defer to Ion on those points. Ion says that conception begins with arousal, and that the soul doesn't happen until the infant takes a breath. Isn't that right, Carol? The first breath is the beginning of the creation of the soul. And what the soul does, it just records all that you're doing and noting the desires that you don't manifest, and those are sent to the guff when you pass on. So that might clarify what you're talking about there, Gorbin.
So are you saying the soul's a notebook?
Yes, it is a diary. Yeah, that's all it is. And it's not your essence. And your essence stays here forever if you want to. But if you offer yourself, you go to the guff. And now the guff is closed, so you actually go to a limbo, a middle ground. And then there's the level that children can't be born unless they have a guff to pick up unrealized creation. So we have to being born today, Corbin? What is being born? Where are they being born from? Because there's no guff to do it. Just wanted to finish that.
What they're being born from is a protoplasmic material created. I can't put it in biological terms because my articulation as a scientist wouldn't let me be able to put it in that terms. But what I'm saying, what you're saying without taking a breath, your diary has not yet begun.
Yes.
Began, and you are not a soul being.
That's right.
You wouldn't say that you're assigned to you, Bobby, you, Carolyn, myself. Bill and Brian, you wouldn't believe in the fact that you were assigned to, put it like this, people can have parallel worlds and lives.
Corbin, I'm going to mute you. I just want to say this. You're going on too long about your point. Ion says that we were never born. Your essence is eternal, and you never went through the born things. There's a lot of mothers who would protest what Ion says, but you have to include that in what you're talking about. And the soul, the whole soul idea is a subset of the essence. What ideas did you get while taking LSD, Brian, that reminds you of what Ion's saying? Any?
I feel like, and whatever I did think or perceive, I would attribute more to mushrooms than to LSD. But I kind of agreed with Terrence McKenna on that side of things, that LSD seems a little bit more artificial and lesser or something than the mushrooms. Basically the morphic fields are real, and that's the real Akashic record or something.
Right. You know,
it really is something like that.
The Evergreen said, I might have even played it during BobFest, because LSD was manufactured, it always gave the same experience. Whereas mescaline and peyote, because they were living, they would respond to the you that had changed or experienced stuff over the past 12 months. So they said it was always good to take it once a year because it would talk to you the way you've become. And then a year later, do it again because you've gone through 12 months of something. And then the mescaline peyote would point out stuff about that. It could respond to the progressive growing you. LSD can't. It can only give the same experience every time.
Right.
I admit it, you, Corbin. You can speak up to that. Your LSD experience or mushroom experience. What do, would you add to what I just said, or Brian?
After having to, much like Timothy Leary, put them, tested out on various people that weren't willing, that had never experienced it before. And giving it to them, both psilocybin, Amanita muscaria, DMT, LSD, and to witness what it would do to them. As far as my personal intake or what I've done with it, I've always considered it a much more magical plane in the sense that I would reach a timelessness that Ion freely expresses and we grapple with, you know. I mean, basically, not that I would not recommend, put it like this, it's not made for some people. Some people, their minds, it's just way too intense for them to handle it. And it can ruin them. It can literally it can enlighten them or it can ruin them. They do need a guide of some sort.
You're saying about LSD. That's LSD.
No, all the above. All the above.
Oh, any of them, okay.
All
you
the
make
above.
A distinction.
And you left out of their ecstasy, too, you know, MDMA.
Well, is that what McKenna talks about? Is DMT? Is that a derivative or not?
No. DMT is a different thing. MDMA is what the kids refer to as ecstasy, where basically they go to these parties and they rave. And,
no, I know about it.
Okay, all
yeah.
the above. But,
so what is that? Is that a have you done that? Have you done MDMA? Is it just a mild thing?
No, oh, it's not mild at all. Oh, no. You're on for a 16-hour adventure.
Oh.
Yeah, most definitely. And then, of course, peyote is another mystical thing, and you usually have to have a guide. I mean, I've been down to the deserts of Mexico and led to certain Indian tribes that after they've checked me out and they would put me through these various weird initiations before bringing me into their faction or their religious leader or the head medicine man, and then he would basically give it to me, and while it was happening, he would turn into things that were for me to ascertain whether they were real or not. What was that movie with Jeff Bridges where he got into the tank, the time? Altered States. Excellent movie. For anybody that has kind of an idea, I mean, it's a bit Hollywoodish where he turns into an ape. That doesn't happen. You won't turn into an ape. You might in your mind. But anyway, you're sitting in the tank and you're in suspended animation where no time exists. It's black. All your senses are deprived. And we've done this to a number of people while trying to get information out of them. And it's very interesting. Now, what's really funny that you mentioned this while we're talking about it, I haven't had a chance to speak to Legend or Andrew. They texted me this week, and I was under the weather. The weather has been, it was down into the 20s and 30s here, and I lost my voice for a day or two. And they texted me and they said, your demons have attacked me. And they're not my demons. No. And they wanted me, I haven't heard the story yet. But essentially it happened to both of them at the same time. And until I've spoken with them and, you know, pretty much, I mean, if
well, Andrew comes in here. We'll ask Andrew if Legend doesn't come. He'll come in many hours from now. But do you need a guide the way you're talking about it for ecstasy?
No, not at all.
You don't.
Ecstasy turns everybody to robots. It turns them into the robot beings. So like all the girls, they start doing the robot dance to the boom, 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 all the music, boom, boom, all those tribal music. And then the guys, they sit there. What? Marco Polo? Yeah.
Hey, were you laughing there, Brian?
I was just saying, because, yeah, the ecstasy, it's a methamphetamine. It's not a, it has a bit of a psychedelic sheen to it, but it's not a psychedelic, really. At heart, it's just a methamphetamine. So, yeah, you're absolutely right when you say it turns people into robots.
Okay, so here's the thing. McLuhan talks about, used to talk about mechanical industrial man was a robot for 500 years, within the visual bias. And then he, in the book that was published after he went on, was The Global Village, and they reversed it. Now, it might have been what actually McLuhan told Bruce Powers, but they reversed it, that the robotic was no longer industrial man, but electronic man. And industrial man became was, in retrospect, angelic. And so you got the word angel In the 60s, he said, okay, the visual man's been robotic, but now we're discarnate, we're becoming angels. But he meant super angels, but people thought at first. I remember Barbara Frum told me, she was doing a book in the mid-70s, and I saw her at a bookstore, 75. You know, she was the Walter Cronkite of Canada, right? You remember Barbara Frum? She was the voice of comfort for the news. Remember that?
Well, she was before my time, but I know who. Yeah, I mean, like, I've heard of her.
Yeah, so she's. I said, "What do you think?" I always ask any of these people, "What do you think of McLuhan?" Well, he's gone into strange places now. He thinks we're all angels. And of course, I'd be chuckling to myself, but I'd find out their dumb, dull perceptions. They didn't have time to understand them. But okay, so we were electric angels. Overcoming the robotic. But then Bruce Power's book comes out, and he says, okay, we were visually biased angels, now we're robots. Now we're past that over the last 15 years. So isn't it interesting that being a robot becomes an entertaining art form? So that means people aren't robotic in this new weird tactility squared Android meme environment, which I say is becoming more and more simulated human scale. It's in the entertainment that came in 20 years ago was to put on the robotic and look like a robot, because you could say doing the Watusi or any of the rock and roll dances look pretty robotic to the older generations, right? So
yeah.
What is it? It's like limited roboticism or exaggerated one-note roboticism is in the ecstasy world. The point is it's an art form. It's accepted. So we are not robotic anymore, and that means the Orwellian or the Huxleyan criticism of our time doesn't apply, because people are enjoying robotism, putting on its value.
Yeah, it's made very clear by Kraftwerk. It's very literal. I saw them on their latest tour. I mean, it's not a recent song, but I saw their latest. I was happy to see their latest 3D visuals tour, and it was very clear that, like, yeah, these guys have a very good what my impression of the Kraftwerk show was, it's very McLuhan / Warhol for babies. We are the robots.
How about the Residents?
Yeah, no, they're interesting. But just before we go into that, did you say the 80s, Brian? Warhol 80s?
No, McLuhan / Warhol for babies. That's what Kraftwerk.
Oh, for babies. For babies.
Yeah.
Wow. And we're all become babies. That's why the fetus was obsolete. But so what do you mean by babies, though? You mean it's immature?
Well, just that it was very, like, just, I mean, I enjoyed it and everything. I don't mean to be looking down on it, but just watching the band Kraftwerk and their songs and their music, the videos that accompanied them, they're very good at, they're very tasteful, but with this very kind of retro-futurist style of computer animation and stuff, and they're all up there on stage, basically, they have actual robots they've made of themselves, and just that music is very, are the robots, it's very simple.
They're not afraid of the robotic, they're putting it on and enjoying it. So, what Corbin's getting at, where the kids can't speak or they're afraid to establish chemical body contact or something, and they won't even be phatic, that's expressing a not eye, not ear, not tactile. There's something new which is pervaded by incredible anxiety, but you can ignore it by the put-on joy of texting and thinking you're communicating in the chip body. We don't have a cultural reference point for that. It's not robotic. It's not eye, ear, or anything. What is it? What is this strange new? It could be the Android meme providing the mystery landscape and everybody communicating to ignore the mystery. And then Ion is the mystery, but the mystery landscape known. But what would you call this strange condition that people are actually in, where the robotic becomes art form because it's the past?
they're running from each other. They basically, until they can have a statistic of that is what's cool, that's what's happening, they have to put out the flow chart and say, okay, is this acceptable? Is that the norm? Is that the range of norms?
They're looking for norms, and they want to fit to the norm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, that would be funny to come up the final answer. We're all brainstorming what is this very new and novel thing that we're in, the normal.
How about this? It's looking for a norm in the TV body and in the chip body, not in the chemical body. You put on the robotic at that level. So they're looking for a centralizing of the chip body weirdness, which means hyperconnectivity. And if you actually try to lengthen out the connectivity, the fatty connectivity, you get panic. So people are looking to connect without connecting, while panic connecting. I guess quadrophenia must be what's going on here. It's some kind of panic quadrophenia. Because they
norm fasting.
Norm fasting, yeah. So when Corbin says they're running, they're not really running from each other, Corbin. You're talking about someone else because they're always in touch. Which body is running, and is running the actual activity? It's like it's so nerve-wracking, and you don't even want to talk to anybody because then you got to explore your nerve-wracking, and it's to be avoided, the awareness of nervousness and unprecedented, no job, no nothing, I don't know where we're going to be, how can we be anywhere, we've been obsolete. That it's not, they're not running from each other, they're running from the effect of what they're doing. Yeah, that's what it is. Well, they're running from the effect of what they're doing.
Everyone's always poking each other.
Yeah, yeah.
This constant frantic poke. So it's almost like they're pushing, instead of running from each other, they're pushing each other not away, really. It's like they're pushing each other away, but more
in
of a
mosh pit.
They want them to constantly be there to push.
Yeah.
What's really alarming is that these youngsters, excuse me, please. Yeah, I'm sorry. What's happening is through the AMA, and it's got to be intentional, if not, is just whatever adjectives you can put to it, just follow the idea. More or less, these kids are becoming sicker and sicker. When you talk to them, instead of being like 80-year-old, 90-year-old people where, oh, I have this callus on my toe or my corn or my cancer or my brain disease or, you know, this or that, these youngsters, they're all ill. They have an illness of a certain type. Oh, I feel this pain here, that I feel this. Pain can be an awareness factor that is most definitely, but it should not happen to somebody that's in their prime within their teens, their tweens, their threes.
But they are. They're gray at three. Now, that's a good point. McLuhan said that pain became the new thing to explore in the 20th century. Even McLuhan said that he did not want to be happy. He wasn't into being happy. He was into exploring his suffering, and he put it in the Christian context. But I think you hit on something here. These kids are making themselves sick to wear on their sleeve the fact that they're exploring pain. That's like the last resort, is to explore pain, to be a human. Now, this is a very important view, Carol.
Is it intentional, or is it...
No, it's unconscious. It's a knee-jerk response to the confusion. Someone says confusion being described. That's what we're describing, confusion, yes, but that, it's not mental confusion. It's not sensory confusion. It's collective multi-body quadriphenic confusion, and the only way to resolve that is to make pain a pleasure, to make a statement of your identity. It's the kind of pain you are saying you got. What's your meds? I mean, we used to see that on the old Slack. Those guys were way up on the meds
but
on back in the 80s.
What does that serve? I mean, when we were that age, we were so active and just pushing the envelope to
the
point.
Well, there was room for the chemical body back then. There was room. There's no room for the chemical body now, and that's why they're acting discarnately as a mosh pit. They're bugging, poking, banging, touching, maintaining, hyperly maintaining kinetic space and tactile space. on a feeling chip body level, which is not a chemical body.
But a mosh pit can be happy. Essentially, basically, a mosh pit can let go of all their anxiety, of all their anger, of all their, confused.
That's why they're staying in contact constantly. That chip body contact is what they require. It's not even bothering into verbal phaticness, just contact. It's like, my ESP is still working. I see that there's something there external to me.
No, that's what I'm saying. Their ESP is disappearing, and they're not even aware.
That's chemical body ESP. I thought Brian was going to say something. Go, Brian.
That it's like with the constant frantic texting, a little poking each other, it's like the building up that throbbing crowd with all the footsteps that are – the footsteps
right.
aren't spent on their normal use value of getting somewhere.
But it's more. It's not a chemical body footstep.
Communicating something.
Yeah, it's not chemical body footsteps.
Build up of pokes. Yeah.
It's chip body footsteps. It's not even sensory. It's a new kind of sensory. It's the 14th sense. But what you're just saying, Kennedy's language would be right, but not for the chemical body.
Yeah.
There's a chip body. We're well past the chip body being an art form. It's been around for a long time, so that's why I showed up, to lurk with a new, making the mystery body visible and knowable. So I definitely think with our products and what we offer is the anti-environment to this chip body agitation. But just repeat, I was pointing out the chemical body. Say again what you mean. Say it as if it's the chip body, the footsteps.
That it's the similar kind of process in the way that he talks about the buildup of this throbbing crowd is all the footsteps being kind of invested in the same place. I mean, he's talking particularly about tribes where literally it would be the stamping thing.
Right. But this one place now is the global membrane, and it's everybody tapping into that.
Right, where usually the steps are their use value is the steps are walking somewhere or moving around, and instead they're being invested in one place, whereas usually the communication is to communicate, the texting and talking is to communicate something. So instead of to communicate something, it's just to invest in this poking.
Yes, the touching, making contact. Ted Carpenter, in They Became What They Beheld, came out in 1970. He begins the book by saying, only connect. So as he saw the decentralization into multi-consciousness, he thought it was quite savvy to connect. Well, now we've got panic connection. You could have schizophrenic connection, paranoid connection, connecting to process, and hysterical connecting and panic and ecstatic panicking. You take my chart and say there are five kinds of connecting process, which is what everybody's forced to do, to assert themselves or to think that there's still somebody there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's see what go ahead.
I was just going to say that that reminds me of one of the sections that I wrote down a bit of that McLuhan underlined a bunch of was when Kennedy is talking about that would be one of those types of connecting that. And Kennedy was talking about this process, this kind of paranoia as a chronic compulsive unmasking.
Yeah.
And McLuhan had a note saying, the impulse to put on a corporate mask and to strip off a private mask.
Good one.
He underlined a bunch of sections, a bunch of little phrases in this, the urge to unmask appearances becomes a kind of tyranny. And a kind of tyranny.
Oh, tyranny! Yes, exactly.
And Kennedy was talking about that is interesting. That in the old archetypal story of the unmasking, that it actually had an object that Proteus and I think Menelaus or something.
Yeah.
Whoever was wanting to talk to Proteus and was saying quit it with the bullshit of all these appearances.
Yeah.
That he was trying to unmask Proteus's appearances because he wanted to talk to Proteus.
Yes.
But then there's a more lost or desperate or chronic version of it where you're either
you're either on some misguided quest to see the real appearance, even though there really is none, or you're just purely addicted to the endless unmasking.
Right.
And no real object of what you're going to do once you get to the bottom.
Right. Now, that's TV, leads into TV landscape masking, you know, what's your image today, public relations world. But today, when you're dangling ganglia, and that seems to be, as we're talking, more what we are, dangling ganglia, looking to see if there's anything else there, and that would explain a video I did with Roxana where the selfie trend in art, the major artists now are just making art about themselves, talking to themselves. So there's no public, nothing to connect with. So then among the people, there's panic connection through the chip body. And what you're describing there was the unmasking of connectivity. No, it's like an individual, it's not a tribal put-on, you know, the corporate mask, the football team you're devoted to and all that, or your business, your corporation. It is a nothing. You're like a subatomic quantum particle who's looking to see if there's even possibility to be an electron, because you've got to have two places at once. I'm talking, it's that ephemeral, but still physical, that is unmasking now. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I would imply what Kennedy's saying, and that's really good that you noticed that, that part. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that it connects to this other very curious note that was in, McLuhan's got a bunch of notes throughout the text, but there's also some on the back page. And one that was very interesting, he says, page 83, river as HCE. Which I thought was very strange because river is ALP.
Right.
That's one of the pretty, it's like HCE is the mountain and ALP is the river. So river as HCE, and you get to the section that he's talking about on page 83, and what Kennedy says is, and McLuhan has underlined the first sentence, what Kennedy says that he was talking about is, a river is the crowd in its vanity, the crowd exhibiting itself.
Right.
All river-like formations, such as processions and demonstrations, want to be seen. They show as much as possible of their surface, extending as far as they can and offering themselves to the largest possible number of spectators. They want to be admired or feared.
Perfect. Now, let me add to that. When you read Don Thiel, you find out why river can apply to HCE. There's two streams in Finnegan's Wake. HCE is the nerves, the communication
right.
among the nerves, and ALP is the bloodstream. So there's two streams going on. And Thiel points that out. McLuhan doesn't, but they would have developed that back in the beginning of the 50s. But that's what river is HCE would be nervous communication, nerves.